Fish are dying off the Florida Keys amid record ocean heat. Haiti is on the brink of falling to gang governance. And we check out an acclaimed new Marielle memoir. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll examine a disturbing maritime mystery, sawfish deaths in the waters off the Lower Keys, and bizarre behavior from other fish species. Could an unprecedented ocean heat wave be to blame? We'll also talk with a Haitian-American leader here who, like most Haitian expats, is urging President Biden to change course in Haiti before it's too late. And we'll hear from Cuban exile and Hialeah son, Edel Rodriguez, about his new graphic memoir, Worm. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. Marine scientists are trying to answer an urgent question. What's causing endangered sawfish to die off the Lower Keys? At least 20 are confirmed dead, and wildlife officials have received reports of about 60 in distress. But that's just one troubling issue. More than two dozen other fish species, including tarpon, snook, grouper, and snapper, are exhibiting bizarre behavior like spinning, struggling to stay upright, or poking their heads out of the water. This all comes amid a global wave of unprecedented ocean heat, upping the ante on the record water temperatures we saw last year. But scientists don't know if that's what's behind crises like the current sawfish kills. Usual suspects like low oxygen, red tide, or high salinity have so far been ruled out. The experts say there's definitely something toxic out there. They just can't identify what it is yet. Either way, this may be an early glimpse of the kind of ocean enigmas global warming has in store for us here. What are your thoughts about this maritime mystery? Do you fish in the Lower Keys? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to help make sense of this conundrum is WLRN's environment editor, Jenny Stiletovich. She's been in the Keys recently, talking to residents and scientists, trying to unravel the riddle. Jenny, how are you?
Thanks, Tim.
Always great to have you on. So this morning, you sent me a pretty striking video from Geiger Key of large sawfish essentially trying to come on shore. That's quite unusual and seems to speak volumes about the crisis we're seeing with these fish, no?
Yes. So this behavior is not normal. No. Sawfish feed in the shallows. They will come into estuaries to give birth. They also feed deep in the ocean. I just talked to a scientist who's with NOAA's sawfish recovery team and asked him, sawfish species around the globe, have you ever seen anything like this before? And he said no.
It's like they're trying to jump onto land. It's almost like they're saying, we want to get out of the ocean. talk about signs of distress.
Yeah, this is, again, not normal behavior. The other fish are exhibiting this kind of spinning behavior that you described. Right. Clearly, it seems to be a neurological issue, which is leading them to suspect that it's toxins.
Thanks for pointing that out. Neurologically, yeah. Like a lot of people, I don't know a lot about sawfish, which are at the heart of this emergency, obviously. Tell us, if you could, a little bit about this particular fish, why it's endangered, and why scientists think it's so vulnerable to whatever it is that's infecting marine life out in the waters off the Lower Keys.
So there are five species of sawfish around the globe. Mm-hmm. Here in the U.S., we have small-tooth sawfish. They're extremely endangered. All sawfish
right,
are endangered.
Right, and remind people why they're called sawfish in the first place. Yeah.
So they have this rostrum, the snout that sticks out. It literally looks like a chainsaw.
Yeah, it looks my hedge trimmer. Yeah.
Yes, and they use that to fish. They sit on the bottom. They wait at the mouths of these channels for schools of bait fish to come out, and then they'll use that rostrum to swim into them and swipe back and forth and stab the fish and then scoop them up and eat them.
Wow. That is cool.
Yeah, it is very cool. It is very cool.
But they are endangered, as you point out.
Yes. So they in about the 1950s, their numbers plummeted. Those snouts get them, mean they can be easily caught in nets. So gill nets and fishing nets and stuff nearly wipe them out. That was one cause. Another was loss of habitat. These shallow estuaries where they give birth to pups have been overdeveloped and polluted. Mm-hmm. And so they lost a lot of those grounds where they give birth. Mm-hmm. They were added to the endangered species list in 2003. They were the very first native fish added to the endangered species list. And the numbers are starting to rebound. The sawfish expert I talked to has been tagging and tracking them. They've got tags on about 100 fish. And they're seeing, they thought they were seeing numbers come back. However, I should say they know a lot about juvenile fish because they're up in the estuaries. Mm-hmm. They do not know a lot about adult sawfish.
Okay, so they really haven't been able to tell yet why they may be so vulnerable to something, you know, bad going on out in the waters out there.
Right. There's theories because they sit on the bottom like rays that whatever toxin is possibly in an algae. Mm-hmm. Is they're more vulnerable because they're down there, or that because the toxin is affecting a lot of bait fish and they're mm-hmm. sitting at the channels, if a school of infected bait fish comes out and they gobble them up, maybe that's uh-huh. the connection.
Yeah.
They're looking at a lot of things, but...
And when we say the lower Keys in this case, where this is all happening, you say we're talking about an area between Bahia State Park and south of Sugarloaf Key.
Right. So it seems to be concentrated. Bahia Honda, Big Pine Keys, mm-hmm. all the way down to Key West. And it's only inshore waters. They're not seeing any kind of fish in distress offshore. It seems to be in the shallow waters near shore.
But as I mentioned earlier, it's not just sawfish that appear vulnerable to this mystery toxin out there, if it is a toxin. Scientists are seeing strange behavior from fish like snook and snapper, but not always the deaths that we're seeing with the sawfish. Here's some audio of you and Little Torch Key residents Greg Furstenworth and Shaley Crawford actually witnessing pinfish violently spinning around in the water.
Usually the baby pinfish will hide in the grasses. Oh, there's one right there. You see it?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
You see it spinning over there?
Uh-huh.
And then
there's
it just...
another one right there.
I mean, that can't be fun for them.
I mean, I've never seen a fish do that, and I feel like I've spent a fair amount of time on the water.
Yeah. And then it just stops and sits on the bottom right there.
Wow.
That's violent, isn't it?
Yes.
For how small that fish is.
So, Jenny, what was the initial theory about what's killing or at least disturbing these fish populations down there? At first, they thought it was probably factors like low oxygen levels or high salinity that can result from the higher ocean temperatures we're seeing. That was sort of the initial impulse.
Right. So the fishing guides and other folks started seeing this as far back as November. And the Lower Keys Fishing Guides Association and Bonefish Tarpon Trust started to collect reports, put together a study group, and recruited two algae experts, a guy at Florida Gulf Coast University and the University of Southern Alabama. They went in and were immediately able to rule out the typical causes of fish kills like low oxygen, red tide, extreme temperatures. Mm-hmm. What they did find was an elevated level of a toxin that's often found in ciguatera.
Okay.
The reason
and,
they were...
And remind us what
ciguatera is. It's a dinoflagellate. It's a disease caused by this dinoflagellate. It accumulates in reef fish. It's an algae that grows on reef. Reef fish eat it.
And when we say a dinoflagellate, is that a kind of bacteria?
It's a single-cell algae.
Okay.
So it occurs naturally. Mm-hmm. The ocean is full of different ones. Sometimes mm-hmm. they're toxic. Sometimes they're not. Mm-hmm. With ciguatera, the fish eat this algae. They can usually tolerate it. They do not get sick, but it accumulates as the fish get bigger, and we can get sick if we eat those fish.
Right.
So the Florida about 10 years ago started monitoring the reefs for this because of the health impact. So when the scientists went out and first discovered this toxin that's found in ciguatera, the only reason they knew it was elevated was because we monitor for it.
Okay.
But when they started examining the fish, they found other toxins as well.
Right. The ciguatera theory didn't pan out really.
Well, it's still a theory.
It's still a theory, but they were
finding multiple toxins. So the question is the toxin found in ciguatera what's killing them or making them sick, or is it the other toxins? And the fact that they only monitor for the ciguatera toxin tipped them off. They don't monitor for the other toxins. So that was just the first thing that they found because they had a baseline to detect the elevated levels. They don't have the baseline for the other toxins because they don't monitor for them. And it points to the fact that we often wait for a crisis and then would react. And the scientists have told me several that if we just did more monitoring, we could have we could see these things coming better. We just don't see them coming.
Did they ever? Do you get the sense that they ever expected to have to do this kind of involved detective work? I mean, this is like an episode of House.
I asked them, is this possibly like a new algae bloom? Is that what we're seeing here? And, you know, with the ocean heat wave that you mentioned, unprecedented ocean heat wave, killing algae, killing seagrass, killing a lot of things down there.
That would have been the simple, you know, solution.
But it also, because it happened so long ago, it happened in July, and then in November you see the fish first starting acting behavioral. It seems like a time gap, but it could have set the stage. It could have changed things enough where everything in the ocean is linked. So you take, you know, one thing out of the link and things start acting differently. And Martin Grossell, who's a University of Miami Rosenstiel scientist, said, you know, are we at a tipping point? Did something happen with that ocean heat wave?
Okay. So there still could be a link then.
There could be a link.
To the heat. Okay.
It will be very difficult tracking things down. I mean, the ocean's just a big soup of stuff. I said to the scientists I've talked to, I'm like, I'm amazed that you ever figure out anything.
Yeah. No. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's environment editor, Jenny Stiletovich, about the mysterious fish kills and other urgent ocean issues off the Lower Keys. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Jenny, I guess the big question at this point is, how concerned or alarmed should we be that they haven't been able to solve this yet?
So I think folks in the Lower Keys are getting alarmed and very concerned because they're in their high season now, tourist season, tarpon season's coming. Fishing guides get a lot of clients this time of year. If tarpon are turning up sick, if word is out that there are fish in distress, they want answers. I think scientists are puzzled that, you know, what is this? It's not the common culprit. So what is going on, and teasing that out and finding answers is difficult. When I talk to the sawfish expert, this is an endangered species, extremely rare. So is this going to do something to that recovery effort? 20 dead sawfish.
But in the bigger picture, though, if the sawfish deaths continue, what other concerns besides their survival as a species should we have in terms of how their disappearance could affect our marine environment? You said, for example, that they're a very important part of the seabed community.
Right. I mean, the numbers had dwindled so much. I think the bigger issue is, whoops, we lose another really incredible species on the planet as far as ecosystem work. I'm, you know, be more worried about all of this, the food chain that's being affected. That's the other thing that's setting off alarms is we're getting a variety of species of different sizes, different, you know, from game fish, big snook and tarpon, which are sturdy fish and can survive in brackish water and pretty on down to the bait fish that, you know, at the bottom of the food chain.
Are you sensing maybe a little panic amongst not just the scientists and officials, but Keys residents and businesses? Because, you know, we're used to seeing things like red tides maybe kill off fish sometimes. It's something maybe that we've come to be able to understand. But this is a mystery, as we've said. This is something that's a little bit beyond our ken. Is that creating a little bit more of a level of panic?
I wouldn't go so far as to say panic, because it's not like with red tide where you just saw beaches littered with dead fish. Uh-huh. These are, you know, you have to go looking for them. They're not huge mats. But the mystery of it, the cause of it, is certainly concerning and alarming. I've heard scientists use both those words. And when a scientist says they're alarmed, you know.
But as an environmental journalist, do you have any concerns about the data that's coming out about all this at the moment?
I'm concerned that it was hard to get data. The scientists have been easy to talk to and have explained the investigation. The Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, as far as the numbers and the reported sightings and the incidents, I've put in a records request for incident reports because I'd like more specifics about when this first was reported, where it was reported, where they're turning up, and I'm not getting that information from them.
Okay. Well, we have Lewis on the line from Fort Pierce. He's got some experience with sawfish fishing. Lewis, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you very much. I was off fishing off Fort Pierce Inlet, which is Hutchinson Island North, and the guy caught a fish who brought it up. It happened to be a sawfish. It had an entire PVC pipe around its saw. The whole length of the blade, which we tried
Okay, so that speaks to what Jenny was talking about earlier, about how those snouts make them perhaps more vulnerable to this sort of thing.
It was incredible. We tried to get it up so we could take it off. It had to be about 8 feet long.
Wow. Wow. Imagine how sharp those teeth are that stabbed into a PVC pipe and got it stuck.
No, that's a good perspective, Lewis. Thank you. Yeah. Jenny, I know we mentioned earlier that they seem to have ruled out a link for now to high ocean heat, although, well, actually not ruled out. It's just not as strong a theory as it might have been before, right?
Well, I mean, I think they're still trying to tease it out because they're spatial, like time-wise, since it's happening so long after, it's not like the direct impact like bleaching. When the coral bleached, because ocean temperatures were super high. Sawfish are big fish, and when events like this happen, they can swim away. I mean, that's what often saves ocean life when you get things like a heat wave or some kind of chemical spill. It's a little fish that can't swim so fast and get away. Big fish make it away. The fact that they're not, and they are also worried that there is a larger number or higher number of dead sawfish than what we're seeing because they typically live on the Gulf side in the mangroves.
Yeah, but that ocean heat though is nonetheless a big elephant in the marine ecology room right now. Around the world, sea temperatures are about a temperature and a half above normal so far this year. We saw last year how that exacerbated the condition of our coral reefs here in Florida, as you just pointed out. What do you fear most if we see even worse ocean heat this year?
That it's coming so soon after this unprecedented heat wave this summer. When you have stressors that pile up, that happen faster and faster, closer together, that's when you worry. A system, the Lower Keys, as Martin Grosselle said, has endured a lot of change. But when you start piling things up, when heat wave after heat wave hit an area, the system gets weakened. The fish get weakened, coral, the reefs suffer, everything suffers, and they're just not able to endure as well as they had when things were healthy.
Now, in the minute we have left here, Jenny, what should we expect next then, not just in terms of solving this sawfish die-off, but also in terms of how we confront the new marine environment challenges out there? What do you see on the horizon?
I mean, I think the big lesson in this is that we need to do better monitored forward thinking so we can kind of predict and see when these things happen. And then once they do determine the cause, how can we change things to make sure that it doesn't happen again? If it turns out not to be ocean heat, but some kind of water condition, what can we do to stop it?
Right. No. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye on this then. This is an important story. Jenny Stiletovich is WLRN's environment editor. Jenny, thanks. Always great to have you on.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, Haitians here are telling President Biden to change his Haiti policy before the country falls to gangs. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Haiti's violent and heavily armed gangs have all but taken over the country. Monday night, they shut down the Toulouse-Louverture International Airport in the capital, Port-au-Prince, with this barrage of semi-automatic rifle fire. Yesterday, they laid siege to Haiti's main seaport. It's all meant to prevent interim Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who the gangs want to resign, from returning to the country. Right now, Henry is sitting in Puerto Rico, so it feels more than ever as if Haiti's on the brink of gang government. This is the lowest point of Haiti's years-long descent into a failed state, one that's gotten deeper and deeper since the country's late President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated 3 years ago. Many now believe U.S. policy to rein in Haiti's chaos has failed. They include most Haitian expats here who say it's a result of President Biden's insistence on supporting unpopular and ineffective elites like Henri instead of fresher leadership. They want Biden to change course on Haiti before it's too late to rescue the country. Do you feel the Biden administration has failed in Haiti? Do you have family there facing this week's gang onslaught? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from Fort Lauderdale is one of South Florida's Haitian community leaders, Michelle Austin Pamis. She's an attorney and a founding member of the Haitian American Foundation for Democracy. Michelle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me and for bringing our problems to light.
I appreciate you being here. Let's first bring our listeners up to speed on where things stand in Haiti right now, Michelle, after this really awful week. As far as we know, Prime Minister Ariel Henry is still locked out of the country, right?
It is correct. He's locked out of the country. But I would like to rephrase a bit and say that he's not just locked out of the country by gangs. He's locked out of the country because he has no credibility and no support among the population. Mm-hmm. So he's gone and there's no one there to defend him. Or
yeah, there is an irony there that, you know, that on the one hand, Haitians are being terrorized by these gangs and have for years with kidnappings, murders, food hijackings, etc. But on the other hand, they are on the same page with the gangs when it comes to getting or wanting to get rid of Henri. Is that a correct assessment?
We can say that it's a correct assessment, but I can say that maybe the Haitian people and the gangs may have differing agendas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's a good distinction to point out, right? Do you yourself, Michelle, though, have friends and family in Haiti who are dealing with this violence right now?
Yes, they are dealing with the violence and they will soon be dealing with hunger. Because
right.
As it stands, you know, with the port attacks and imports being limited and Haiti importing 65% of what it consumes, difficulty obtaining water.
Yeah.
All of that is going to be happening besides the violence and the fear.
Now, in a Florida International University forum this week, Michelle, you predicted that Henri would resign. Do you still think that's going to happen? And if it is going to happen, how soon do you think it will?
I think that even if he's holding out this very second, he's on his path to resignation. It's clear. You can't come into the country. You don't have support to try to help you get there. Meaning, so far the U.S. has done one very positive thing, is that the U.S. government hasn't said that they would assist him in returning.
Right. And many have taken that to mean that the U.S. too wants him to resign, right?
That's the view that I have of it. Yes, I feel that the U.S. now realizes that this is not the horse to back. And it's brought the country to despair. So the U.S. is not standing by him either.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I mentioned, the gangs have been terrorizing Haiti for years now, especially after the 2021 assassination of President Moïse. But what, to your mind, made this latest gang offensive different? What different and more frightening place is Haiti in right now as a result of what happened this week?
Well, what happened this week is a demonstration that the gangs do not fear the police. That's really what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, they were out there attacking people, and sometimes the police were not present. And today I'd say there are no police officers on the streets of Haiti today. They're just out. But what happened this week is that if they attacked the police directly,
right?
They attacked the prisons directly.
Right. We should point out that they attacked and burned down more than a couple police stations, correct?
Correct. So what this shows is that it's moved from just the gangs attacking each other, the gangs kidnapping individuals on the streets. It's moved to the gangs directly attacking the infrastructure of the police.
Right.
And therefore, the prime minister, who could not protect the country from the gangs, now cannot protect himself.
Right. And on top of that, they released thousands of criminals, inmates, from at least two prisons in Haiti during this violence as well, right?
Correct. And the fact that they have means that whatever gang members were inside these institutions are now reinforcing the gangs.
Right. And which is why a lot of experts are calling this not just gang violence, but a gang uprising. I mean, in a rebel sort of sense rather than just a criminal sense.
They are calling it that. They might even say that they are rebels. But I would venture to say that what they are doing, maybe the people agree that all y'all should go, but they may be doing it in order to promote some kind of gang control of the country or gang representative control of the country, which is contrary to the people's interests.
Right, it's the sort of criminal insurrection we've seen sometimes. I used to cover. I used to live in Mexico, and we saw that with the cartels, for example. Not just criminal violence, but what we used to often call a criminal insurrection to sort of take more control of things. And that definitely seems to be happening in Haiti now. But as this new spasm of violence was happening, Henri was in Kenya, finalizing a UN deal to bring 1,000 Kenyan police officers to Haiti to help restore order. Michelle, that plan looks pretty questionable now, but even from the beginning, did it seem like a real solution to Haitians like yourself?
Well, I think that our perspective, at least at the Haitian American Foundation for Democracy, has always been that in order to bring in security support from the international community, we needed to have in place a government in that country capable of working with that international security team. So, from my perspective, it's not a no to having security support because if the gangs have all the guns and there's no other side, Haiti will need support, but it needs it with the right leadership to make a difference. I believe that I think it's not dead. I think the issue is now to get the right leadership in place to work with the international community. And also, we need US support more directly. It can't just be pass it off to the Kenyans.
But I mean, as you point out, everyone agrees that whatever the solution is, it has to be a Haitian solution. But even so, under the circumstances, will the U.S. and the international community, as you've just hinted here, in the immediate moment, have to intervene more forcefully now? Or does that simply carry too many risks of making the situation worse, as we've seen so often in the past? I mean, it's a real conundrum, is it not?
It is a conundrum, but the language around the Haitian solution never met Haitians on their own by themselves. What is being proposed is that the Haitians in country know best what it is, which groups, which sectors can come together to give the country the right leadership. And they've been proposing it for quite some time. And they're getting closer and closer. As we speak, there are a lot of discussions going on to present it a more or less united front. Maybe you won't have 100%, but a more or less united front to say the key sectors of this society present a plan for its leadership. And the US, and then we would have support from the international community. The Haitians propose, but get the support from outside.
Now, as I mentioned, much, if not most, of the Haitian diaspora here lays a lot of the blame at the foot of at the feet of President Biden, mainly because he has insisted on supporting Prime Minister Henri. You said this week that you hope the U.S. finally realizes that it's been, quote, backing the wrong horse, that Henri has very little legitimacy in Haiti. Why was Henri the wrong horse, and what have been the biggest failings of his caretaker government in Haiti, would you say?
I could say it in a nutshell, his caretaker government has simply failed to govern. Period. It's not as if there are a lot of people out there able to articulate what it is that has been accomplished on behalf of the Haitian people. They came to try to put together a proposal for an election. It's been over 2.5 years. They haven't been able to do that. They haven't been able to work on the security. They've appointed folks that at the police that haven't been supportive of the community. Just generally speaking, nothing advanced. And the US, not wanting maybe a debacle, kept saying, well, at least we have someone there and can communicate with that person. But I think at the end of now, the US realizes that that debacle happened with that person. And I'm very hopeful that they are now completely changing policy and will accept a Haitian proposal for a solution.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Haitian community leader Michelle Austin Pamis about the crisis in Haiti and whether the U.S. should change course there. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Michelle, is there perhaps a silver lining to this latest violence, if you could call it that, in the sense that it could finally force the U.S., the U.N., the Caribbean community, or CARICOM, and countries like Canada, for example, to change course and promote a different sort of transitional government that could finally lead Haiti to, for example, the new elections it so desperately needs, as you pointed out?
Yes, I think that finally, maybe, we'll have the opportunity to see in Haiti a coalition government, a government that is more representative of the Haitian people and the sectors of society that are more reasonable, less corrupt. And that if that were to happen, I guess that would be the silver lining to all of this.
But is that manifested by, for example, this coalition of civil society leaders known as the Montana Group, which has long ago presented a plan for a transition that the Biden administration seems to have perhaps not taken very seriously?
Perhaps. I wouldn't just say the Montana Accord would be the one that is proposed for a solution for the country. I would say that the group that constitutes the Montana Accord, along with very active other sectors of society who are reasonable participants, together they'll come with a plan, and they're working on it as we speak.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I hope that they get support.
But have they coalesced enough for this moment? I mentioned, for example, to a Haitian expat here this morning that you and I would be discussing this today, and he asked me to ask you, why hasn't the political opposition in Haiti, and again, we're talking about all these coalitions and elements of civil society that you and I have just been discussing, why hasn't the political opposition in Haiti come to a consensus yet on how to proceed? What's holding that up, do you think?
I think that they're pretty much at a consensus. Can I say that? I believe so. I believe today they're pretty much at a consensus. And the people outside of the consensus may just not be part of the future. Mm-hmm. Because you can't have 100% participation in any plan. Where in the U.S. right now, it would be as if we were saying, why can't the Republicans and the Democrats just get along?
Yeah.
Agree on plan A. Mm-hmm. I think that what's happening is that if we get to a point where you have 80% of the significant sectors uniting, that could be enough. And they need the support of the international community to move forward. If they can get 100%, so be it. But if they can't, we need for the international community to allow those who come together with lofty goals of helping to improve the situation in their country, allow them to attempt it.
All right. We have Philip on the line from here in Miami, has a thought here about how we should be coordinating foreign intervention in Haiti if it does come. Philip, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What do you have to say about this?
Yes, hi. I'm Philip Brutus. I'm a former state rep here.
Yes, I know you well.
You know me. Okay. 2 points. Very simple. Why spend $400 million on foreign troops when that money can be put to the ground with some strong institutions on the ground doing work and reform these institutions, police, and you know, the courts and everything? Number two, Benin, which is an African country that speaks French that has a direct lineage to Haiti, offered 2,000 soldiers. Why waste time with Kenya if you need to have an intervention? Okay. Why not let Benin come in? They speak French. Haitians speak French. Right. Kenya speaks Swahili and English. Haitians don't speak that. That's the debacle right there. So I think that's the two things. If you're going to have it, do somebody that wants to do it, speak the language, or put the money on the ground.
Good points. Michelle, in the 30 seconds we have left here, can you respond to Mr. Brutus's thoughts there?
Well, I have to say that, Philip, I know you too. And my view on it is that it's not up to us. It's a question that you could put out there to those in the international community supporting the intervention. I think that for the people who are talking around a table or trying to come up with a solution, once they are installed, they should be the ones working with the international community to direct what it is that they want for the country.
Okay. Fort Lauderdale attorney Michelle Austin Pamis is a founding member of the Haitian American Foundation for Democracy. Michelle, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, we speak with the author of the new Marielito memoir, Worm. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Headlines out of Hialeah these days suggest the second largest city in Miami-Dade County is under strain from a new influx of Cuban migrants. It's reminiscent of a time more than 40 years ago, in 1980, when Hialeah experienced another sudden surge of Cuban migrants, who were known as Los Marielitos because they were among the 125,000 Cubans who arrived in South Florida that year from the Cuban port of Mariel. One of those Marielitos was 8-year-old Edel Rodriguez. He grew up to be a nationally recognized artist and graphic designer, known especially for his cover illustrations for Time magazines, where he and I were actually colleagues many, many years ago. Rodriguez has now written and illustrated an acclaimed graphic memoir titled Worm, A Cuban-American Odyssey, about his family's dramatic Mariel escape from Cuba, their struggles in Hialeah, and eventually his triumph in New York. Edel Rodriguez is in town for a presentation of Worm tonight at Books and Books in Coral Gables, and he joins me now here in the studio. Edel, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks for having me here.
Have you read Worm? Do you remember the Mariel boat lift? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, obviously, Edel, congrats on the success of Worm, and I guess we should start by explaining the book's title. Worm, or gusano, was the insult Cuban dictator Fidel Castro hurled at Cubans like your family that wanted to leave his communist island. But why did you end up choosing that epithet as the title for your book?
It was actually one of the first decisions I made was the title, yeah. And I went from there. So I didn't really want to change it once I headed that direction. And the reason is that kind of the cover itself, you know, having been an art director, and I think of cover and what would grab your attention. It was this image of a child who was about 8-9 years old who was doing everything he was supposed to do. He's got a beret, he's got a bandana, but you still, you know, the revolution still called him a worm just because his parents wanted a better future for him.
Yeah, and I love the juxtaposition of using that title, Worm, along with that drawing of yourself as a little boy in your communist young pioneer outfit. Was that an intentional middle finger at the Castro regime?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I do in my work, anytime that someone hurls an insult or comes at me in some way, I use that in my work. I not that I welcome it, but I'm not afraid of insults. It's, you know, I try to make something out of basically nothing.
I know the feeling. In the early part of the book, I was struck by how you laid out your evolution as a kid in the rural Cuban town of Gabriel, correct? From wanting to be the good little revolutionary wearing the scarf and the red beret to becoming more aware of the toxic oppression the Castro regime heaped on families like yours. You told the New York Times recently that you have little patience, and understandably so, with leftists who romanticize Cuban communism. What do you want folks to take away from that early narrative in your book?
Yeah, the narrative, and I did spend, you know, probably about 7 or 8 chapters explaining that we were kind of a regular family, almost a middle class family in Cuba. We didn't for where we were, you know, we weren't that political. And it is to understand that we had a good life. You know, what makes you leave all that behind? You know, we were kind of at peace. We weren't fleeing a war. It was something just didn't feel right. The way the government was from the time I was 4 or 5, they start indoctrinating children to become part of the revolution. By the time they're 16, 17, they're in the army. And it's a system that my parents felt very uncomfortable. They didn't like the way the government was pulling the children out of the home and bringing them to these country schools. Basically kind of like driving a wedge between the parent and the child.
Well, even a darker factor, and the book ends on this very gripping note when you describe how your father explained to you in the end why He wanted the family to leave.
Yeah, Cuba. and I didn't really know that until I interviewed him for the book. We had conversations with my mother and my father, and at some point I wanted to know. They had always been afraid of taking any risks. They didn't like boats.
Right.
And I'm like, what made you do that? And he finally, you know, turns off the mic and explains, because I was recording him,
yeah,
explains what was the final straw that made him made that courageous move to get out of the country.
He was under threat himself.
Yeah.
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 That all leads, of course, to your family jumping at the chance to escape Cuba in the Mariel boatlift of 1980 when Castro decided to let, as I said, 125,000 Cubans leave for Miami as a way of sticking his finger in the eye of the U.S. more than anything else. But it wasn't as easy as just hopping on a boat. You show us what a really long and harrowing process getting to Florida was, including sharing a boat with criminals that Castro had spitefully released from prison to be part of that exodus. What was most important to you to convey about that drama, and what was the most important effect it had on the Cuban-American you are today?
Well, there were a few reasons why I wanted to spend a lot of time on that moment of leaving. And
yeah,
there's perception here where that you just left your house, you got in a boat, you're in Miami the next day.
Yeah,
and there
exactly
was a very long process of like drawn out punishment from the Cuban government. They put you in a detention camp called El
yeah
Mosquito.
Oh, awful scenes.
We were there for a long time. They would pull people out, beat them at their workplace, bring them back. There was very, very little food. So it was a bit of, oh, you want to get out of the country, we're going to give you a final goodbye.
Yeah.
And it was also a processing center where they would bring the families, they would bring prisoners from jails, people from insane asylums, and create kind of a hodgepodge of a group that they would place on the boat. They wouldn't let the families just leave with the family members that came to get them. You had to take prisoners and prostitutes and all sorts of things back on into the United States.
And you make the observation on the boat as you're finally leaving that you're looking at these criminals as an 8-year-old boy, and you're realizing later on that perhaps one of the things that made you safe in their presence was that they just seemed lost because this was the first time they'd been out of confinement.
Out, and my father could tell right away, wait, these people are sharply dressed. They would dress them in suits.
Right.
You know, and they had passports. We didn't have passports. We had no paperwork.
Yeah.
But these guys showed up with fresh passports. It was like a process that Castro had established to basically get rid of the worms, anybody that was
right,
a threat to his power.
I'm Tim Padgett. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm speaking with Adel Rodriguez about his graphic memoir, Worm, recounting his experience as a child of the Mariel boatlift. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So after your family arrives in the boatlift, and I love that one little beautiful detail, it was almost Proustian, of you tasting an apple for the first time that's handed to you when you arrive in Key West, but you settle in the Cuban enclave of Hialeah. And at one point you say, for me, America was Hialeah, a place we call El Exilio, exile. The name made it feel temporary, a placeholder. It was somewhere to be until the day it was safe to go back home to our friends and family in Cuba. But the book itself, I have to say, seems to convey a very different reality for you, that Hialeah wasn't some waiting room until the return to Cuba, as so many exiles did and still do see it. But rather, it was like a way station to something beyond Hialeah in America, meaning, in your case, New York. How was your exile outlook different from, let's say, the mainstream outlook here?
Well, I think, you know, at the beginning when we came here as a kid, I really thought I was going to go back and be with my grandparents again. That was my main thought.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then the years kept passing. And at some point you realize, wow, we are here. This is a permanent thing. And then I realized, okay, I want to make something of myself. We're not going back to Cuba any longer. And I really did feel that I didn't want my parents, everything they went through, you know, the difficulties, that I didn't want it to be for nothing. So what I got, once I realized that was going to stay here, then I wanted to make something of myself to prove to my parents that their sacrifice was worth something. And that's when I decided, okay, I want to be an artist. all my teachers said, if you want, really want to be an artist, go to New York City.
Right.
And then I went off in a new adventure.
But I was also struck by the panels that describe school kids disparaging you as a, quote, ref mm-hmm. or refugee.
That was very common.
Yeah, it was a reminder that more established Cuban exiles here for many years were not very accepting of Marielitos, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
So I was also curious, as you discovered your artistic talent as a kid here, did that Marielito experience sort of prod you to start looking beyond Hialeah when you thought about your future and what you wanted to do?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, I began to meet people who were artists here, and I really did realize they were that kind of a part-time artist. There wasn't real back in the 80s. There wasn't a very big arts community here in Miami,
mm-hmm.
And I figured out that I really, if I wanted to make this as a life, and a way of life, I had to go to a place that appreciated it at the time.
But did that Marielito alienation, let's say, have any sort of effect on sort of turning your head in that direction?
You know, I grew up being called a worm.
Yeah.
So being called a ref right. and a Marielito, nothing, mm-hmm. you know, bothers me. And now with the work that I do,
yeah.
I get called even worse things by Cuban refugees who
yeah.
think I'm a communist, who think I'm this because of my political art.
Yeah.
So I don't really take insults. They don't really bother me.
I want to turn to that now. One of the big points of tension in the book is how, when you move to New York to study art and then become an award-winning illustrator for Time magazine, you not only broke with Hialeah geographically, but maybe philosophically and politically in many ways, too. And that's most apparent in your editorial approach to former President Donald Trump. When he won the presidency in 2016, your Time cover illustration of him was not exactly flattering. Why, not just as an American, but as a Cuban-American, do you object to Trump? And did you know even back then that you were going against the much more favorable opinion of Trump that your hometown of Hialeah has today?
Well, when I make art, I make it from the heart. I don't really I feel like I'm, you know, making work that represents the community. I'm just,
right.
What do I feel? And from the get-go, I heard Trump say some of the very same things that Castro had said. His first it was the attack on the press, calling them the enemy of the people. That's
yeah.
something that Fidel had said. Calling people, most recently he called them vermin, which is the foundation
right.
word for worm.
Worm, yeah, it might as well be gusano, yeah.
Yeah, so and back in 2016, it was a constant array of things that just reminded me of a caudillo, I'm going yeah. to take over this place and it's going to be my way or the highway, and I felt it was a danger, so I began making my work. Even before the election, I was just doing kind of an online social media campaign, and eventually magazines kind of, you know, saw what I was doing. Art directors from magazines saw what I was doing in Twitter and other places,
mm-hmm.
and realized, called me and said, can we do that for the cover? I was actually surprised that they called me. I mean, we've all both worked at magazines.
Yeah.
Generally, a campaign, you do this even-handed, both-side-ism, and I felt this was not the time for that. We had to really confront it. That was 2016.
Right.
It all came true in 2021, and now we are where we are.
But you describe in the book how it even caused a rift with your mother.
Oh, yeah.
At one point,
yeah.
right? which I'm assuming has meant
it. It has been fixed.
Right. Okay.
Partly because, you know, the behavior got more, and, you know, by the time the insurrection happened, my mother realized, okay, we are in deep trouble. This guy's, you know,
okay.
problem. And the way he handled COVID and all that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that has all worked
yeah, it's
out
all
for you.
It's all good.
Adele Rodriguez is the author of the graphic memoir Worm, A Cuban-American Odyssey. He'll present the book this evening at 7 p.m. at Books and Books in Coral Gables. Adele, congrats and many thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Finally on the roundup, from that discussion with one of South Florida's most important Hispanic artists, let's remember something else very important about the Hispanic community here. Its vote. Next Thursday evening, WLRN, the Miami Herald, and Nuevo Herald, CBS News Miami, and Univision Miami have organized a town hall event open to the public. It's called Voters Decide, the Hispanic Vote 2024. It will be hosted by Florida International University at its Graham Center, and it will include a panel of local Hispanic political and media experts from across the spectrum, Republican and Democrat, pro-Biden and pro-Trump, and somewhere in between. CBS4 anchor Elliot Rodriguez will moderate. The Hispanic Vote 2024 Forum will begin at 8 p.m. It will be simulcast online at WLRN.org and MiamiHerald.org, and it will be broadcast on CBS4. And while we're talking about what's coming up, don't forget to set your clocks and watches 1 hour ahead before you hit the sack Saturday night. And take a nap on Sunday, like I will, to get back that lost hour of sleep. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Helen Acevedo with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our Director of Original Live Programming. Mateo Sanchez is Digital Editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News. The Vice President of Radio and the show's Technical Supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.